All right. The time is 4 minutes in the of 6 o'clock, and this is Early Morning Scoop. A very, very good morning to you, all the Eagle FM listeners. No matter where you are tuning in from, whether you are still in bed, whatever you are doing, thank you so much for always choosing us, and we really, really appreciate your effort. And this is Early Morning Scoop, a program dedicated to you, to providing you with the latest update on the economy, entrepreneurship, public policy, trade, everything. In terms of money, we all give you or give it to you. And of course, I'm your host, Lisa Shimi, and I'll be with you until the hour 7:30 just to give you that or the usual update. And before I get to that session of the international segment, please don't forget to connect with us on our social media platforms, Eagle FM Namibia on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, as well as the Village Newspaper page on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Do not also forget to subscribe to our WhatsApp channel just for the daily news update and, of course, the newspaper alerts. And, of course, do not forget to download our app, Eagle FM Namibia, Eagle FM, on your Google Play Store and, of course, on your App Store. And do not forget also to either download our IMBA app on your Google Play Store and, of course, your App Store, just also to make it easier for yourself. I mean, having an app or having an Eagle FM app, it's just so good. Wherever you are around the world, you can able to tune in and just listen to your favorite shows. Whether you missed out from maybe from other past shows, you can able to tune in and still just listen through the podcast. We have all that lined up just for you to go listen them. And please just do make sure that you download that beautiful app. Now, to start off international, is that the extreme weather is disrupting global food chains, from Brazil's worth orange harvest indicate addressing cocoa and coffee prices in West Africa. Now, the floods are destroying crops in South Africa as climate change reshaped what we eat, and it caused the G20 Agriculture Working Group met in South Africa this month just to promote climate resilience through data-driven farming technology and inclusive investment. We might take a listen to this particular update.
Ismail Amin's journey into Tuli cattle farming was met with high feed costs, water and electricity shortages, and disruptive weather patterns gathering over KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa. The province has become wetter and prone to flooding in the last 10 years, something Amin has had to navigate carefully to stay in business.
We're living in a difficult time of climate change. And we've had to adapt and change our types of farming and our methods of farming with climate change. So we're dealing with more precision farming. The Tuli is a big part of my success in farming with climate change, because they are adaptable and they do well in most areas.
The young farmer has turned to regenerative farming and technology to better monitor and manage operations.
Collecting data, analyzing this data, and watching the changes helps us make these decisions and inform decisions when we're doing our farming practices. And this way, it's not just a rational decision and it's calculated, so that we can mitigate these risks and still be productive in the long run.
KwaZulu-Natal often reaches scorching temperatures when the rain dries up. Nearby Ubora Farm finds technology a big help to monitor its chicken flock, which are highly sensitive to changing conditions.
We record everything that we do on a daily basis, and that definitely does help us to track the patterns. If there's any problems, we can see it, we can pick it up immediately. For instance, if we know that every day we are collecting 100 eggs, and then all of a sudden, tomorrow we're collecting maybe 40 eggs, then we know there's a problem.
Data-driven and tech solutions in the face of relentless climate change were topics on the table at the G20 Agricultural Working Group, taking place 300 kilometers away from the farms in the port city of Durban, which itself has been battered by waves of flooding.
We need to look at how we build resilience, and it is a reality, it's going to be with us, and it focuses then on new breeding techniques, how you build and breed new crops that are more climate resilient, and also how you use farming methods to ensure that you're more environmentally sensitive to what you are trying to do.
South Africa's G20 leadership and BRICS membership also opens doors for African farmers in new markets.
We believe to increase the market exposure for African agriculture exports and investment opportunities, because we need investment in African agriculture to be able to increase efficiencies, modernization, commercialization, so we can then in turn access markets such as China, India, and of course even some of our trade partners in Europe.
The G20's work is of critical importance, especially to Africa, where 1 in 5 people have no food. Adding to that is the impact of climate change already ravaging crops and livestock and threatening food security. The way forward is through a meaningful partnership and investment to build Africa's agricultural sector, not...
All right, there you have it. Now, going in Zambia is that the Ministry of Energy says it has started receiving bids from oil marketing companies that want to use the Tanzama pipeline. Now, this follows the successful completion of the review of guidelines government at the Tanzama pipeline on open access for framework. Now, Ministry of Energy Principal Public Relation Officer says the OMCs, both local and foreign, are free to bid to use the pipeline to transport a diesel from Dar es Salaam to Zambia. That's what they said. Of course, this says the deadline of the invitation for bids is slated to be on or for the 30th of April this year, 2025.
1,710 kilometer Tazama pipeline has long been a vital artery in Zambia's fuel supply chain since its inception. Stretching from Dar es Salaam to Ndola, the pipeline has entered a transformative phase this year, anchored in sweeping reforms in the energy sector that now allow third-party access. On the 1st of April, the open access framework officially came into force for the Tazama pipeline. Following this, the Ministry of Energy initiated a comprehensive review of the framework.
The open access regime under Tazama pipeline has seen a lot of benefits so far, and we hope we can really actualize further these benefits. The revision of the guidelines was concluded successfully, and the stakeholders pushed in a lot of responses, of course positive and negative, that prompted the Ministry and Tazama of the Energy Regulation Board to sit down and then revise these guidelines just to be in tune with the expectations of people, the players out there.
Upon completion of the review, a formal call for bids was made, inviting private sector players to tap into the pipeline system under fair, transparent and regulated conditions.
Bidders will have to run the pipeline for the next 6 months. So this is one of the good things that we are doing to make sure that there's competition. And Tazama, through the ministry, is actually encouraging OMCs, local OMCs, if they're able to team up with the foreigners, they can team up so that they bid for this opportunity to use the pipeline. This pipeline is one of the measures that this government has put in place to improve competition and participation of the local people in the petroleum industry.
For stakeholders in the energy landscape, this new framework signals more than just policy change. It heralds a collaborative era, blending public and private efforts to reshape Zambia's energy infrastructure.
And I want to believe that what government has started is aimed at enhancing the principles of transparency and fairness, and to ensure that the public expectation is being managed properly. But when you have got more actors in the market, the competitiveness nature of that space ensures that the possibility of being exploited are eliminated or minimized.
And the momentum doesn't stop there. In another strategic move, government approved the open access policy on electricity and energy, another key step designed to unlock private investment in the sector. With this, independent power producers, IPPs, are being actively encouraged to enter the energy market. Aligned with the ambition to generate 1,000 megawatts of electricity from solar power, government has recorded steady progress towards that goal.
These investors are coming in every day. I gave you an average of 5 to 6. And we have 2 platforms, that is online and those walk in. So from each front, we have these people coming in to show interest to invest in Zambia. So actualization To start with, I can tell you that is come next month, this is May, we have 1,000 megawatts, 100 megawatts of solar power that is being launched by the president in Chisamba. We have many more lined up, but by December, we hope this mission of 1,000 megawatts.
All right, there you have it. The time is 14 minutes in the of 6 o'clock, and this is early morning scoop. Now, to move on to the next item is that the World Health Organization has achieved a breakthrough in pandemic response efforts following the COVID-19 pandemic, which exposed significant gaps in global health systems and left Africa at the back of the vaccine queue. Now, most WHO member states have agreed on a draft pandemic accord. The agreement will be considered for adaptation in May. We might take a listen.
Reached by the World Health Organization could change the way countries respond to pandemics. After 3 years, 13 rounds of deliberations and headbutting among 193 member countries, a legally binding treaty has been finalized without the United States.
This pandemic agreement is going to, one, to make the world safer. The second is that it's intended to ensure that the prevention and preparedness as well as response measures are in place in the event that you have another pandemic.
The race to tackle pandemics better was born out of the failings of COVID-19, which left health systems flatlining and poorer countries clinging onto survival without vaccines. Among the key elements are commitments to enhance technology, strengthen global resources and workforce capabilities, funding and knowledge sharing on diseases.
When outbreaks happen, we need to have characterized what the pathogen is that causes the outbreak, whether, you know, the method of spread, the speed at which it spread, how rapid it is, and be able to then determine how best to come up with preventative measures or to come up with your response, or also public health measures that are necessary.
South African-based tech company Afrigen Biologics spearheaded a groundbreaking WHO-backed initiative to develop the mRNA vaccine at the height of the COVID-19. It's now taking up the fight against other diseases plaguing the continent and has the go-ahead to produce the Rift Valley fever vaccine. Such efforts could be strengthened by the pact.
To further build the capacity, the capabilities to innovate and develop new vaccines, not Rift Valley fever, one of it, but others, is incredibly important for South Africa, as South Africa fosters health security and as South Africa prioritizes this sector as a key contributor to health security for the continent.
Since the pandemic, African leaders and the Centers for Disease have been pushing for medicines to be produced locally to reduce dependency on imports.
The pharmaceuticals must be manufactured here and be bought here on the African continent, because we buy our pharmaceuticals in other continents, especially generics from India and originator drugs from the USA and Europe. So it's high time that Africa must think about standing on its own.
The fight started by the continent for equitable access to healthcare during COVID-19 may finally be paying off. It's only the second time in the WHO's history that an agreement of this magnitude has been reached, the first being the Tobacco Control Treaty 12 years ago. The new pandemic agreement is expected to be adopted at the World Health Assembly in May, setting the groundwork for the G20 Health Ministers meeting later.
All right, there you have it. Now, the 39th Tunis International Book Fair is underway in Tunisia's capital, with China honored as the year's special guest. Now, the event began on Friday and runs until May 4th, highlighting the strengthening cultural ties between Tunisia and China and paves the way for expanded cultural and, of course, artistic exchanges. We might take a listen to this.
It inaugurated the Tunis International Book Fair. The head of state visited the Chinese pavilion, where he expressed strong support for the concept of building a community with a shared future for mankind, proposed by Chinese President Xi Jinping.
This is a big event. It's the first time that China is the guest of honor of this international book fair.
China's participation as a guest of honor is a valuable opportunity for Tunisian literary enthusiasts, bibliophiles, and publishing experts to learn about Chinese culture, arts, and heritage.
Walid Ahmed Fershishi is a renowned Tunisian poet who has also translated and published hundreds of books. He says visitors have been better informed and many of them even impressed by China's pavilion.
Today, we are living in a world where culture has become an element of economic growth. This pavilion is a witness to China's greatness as a country and a culture. Tunisia's and China's cultures can be complementary in many aspects.
Martez Boularas is a Chinese language student at the prestigious University of Carthage in Tunis. He is exploring language learning books. Martez is also amazed with China's ancient and modern history manuals.
Learning Chinese has paved the way for discovering China's rich history. It was my field of study before becoming my passion. It's an enjoyable journey.
Hiba Zawem and her friends are fans of Chinese animated works, which are based on traditional as well as modern Chinese literature.
China is a great country. The Chinese dragon is waking up, and culture is a manifestation of this power. This is an opportunity to dive into Chinese culture by reading literature and watching animated works.
In recent years, with deepening academic exchanges between China and Tunisia, thousands of students have acquired better language skills. Many Chinese students in Tunis are also promoters of increased cultural and academic exchanges between the two sides.
I think that this initiative has brought people together. I'm learning Arabic, and my Tunisian friends are learning Chinese. This is an excellent way to initiate dialogue between our two cultures.
The Chinese Pavilion at the Tunis International Book Fair, which spans more than 500 square meters, has been hosting intellectual seminars and dialogue sessions that bring together Chinese writers with their Tunisian, Arab, and African counterparts. Over 100 Chinese cultural figures are attending the fair, representing 40 Chinese publishing houses.
All right, and the time is 22 minutes in the of 6 o'clock, and this is early morning scoop. Now, to move on to the next item, is that the EFF has welcomed at a higher court order suspending the finance minister's VAT increase announcement. Now, it comes after the DA, EFF, and the minister, Enoch Godowana, are settled out of court. Now, EFF, a spokesperson, says the order vindicates his party. We might take a listen to this update.
50% each. Well, joining us, of course, is to give us their reaction is the EFF's spokesperson, Snao Tambo. Snao, good evening to you. Thank you so much for joining us. Just to your reaction as the EFF, having seen that order of the court welcoming it, I imagine.
Absolutely. We welcome the court order from the Western Cape High Court, which now legally, lawfully, and bindingly suspends the 0.5% VAT increases which were meant to take place on the 1st of May 2025, but also sets aside the legally adopted fiscal framework and revenue proposals, which were adopted by the Standing Committee on Finance on the 1st of April and the National Assembly on the 2nd of April, because we've always argued that the process that occurred in those meetings wherein we sit were irregular and procedural, and we even warned the Speaker of Parliament on the 2nd of April that we will be taking it to court. So this is a vindication that we as the EFF were correct, but also it is a vindication that in terms of protecting constitutionalism and the integrity of parliament as the process where you can actually implement or reverse legislation. We saw in the past week the African National Congress alongside a lot of bridesmaid political parties which supported their illegal fiscal framework and VAT increases, pronouncing a reversal of a VAT increase based on a media statement by the Minister of Finance where he said he intends to reverse the VAT hike. Now, that was not legally binding, that was not lawful, and anyone who took that as a representation that there won't be VAT hikes on the 1st of May was misled. Now, this court order effectively says that, for example, the ignorant statement by the Circuit Revenue Services, which stated that there will be 15% and 15.5% VAT hikes operating concurrently until the 15th of May, are nonsensical and unlawful. So we are extremely pleased with this process, and I think we should affirm at this moment in time that, as the Commander-in-Chief and President of the EFF said in the Freedom Day rally held in Brandfort in the Free State, as we're sitting here together as South Africans, South Africa does not have a budget under Cyril Ramaphosa's government.
But let us into what happened before we see this order of the court that is being shared with us, and obviously we share with the nation the breaking news that officially, according to the court as well, that increase not going to happen. I think that needs to be emphasized. But in the back end, what would have taken place? Was it the finance minister's legal team reaching out to yourselves? What did that conversation look like? So now, are you still there?
Yes, I'm still here.
Yeah, go ahead.
The conversation occurred in the sense that the Minister of Finance outlines in his papers that he is... has been swayed by recent developments as it relates to the fiscal framework and revenue proposals and the VAT increases, and that he sees that he did not have the necessary political support to proceed with the VAT hikes. Now, that lack of necessary political support, he says he came to that realization on the 21st of April, because before that, he was of the belief that there was sufficient support in the National Assembly for those VAT hikes. And that sufficient support, he drew that conclusion from the fact that he had a support for his fiscal framework, which contained those 0.5% increases from political parties such as Action SA, Build One South Africa of Musi Maimane, Rise Mzansi of Songa Zibi, amongst many other political parties. And it was the court processes last week where Advocate Nugai Tobi demolished the arguments of the Minister of Finance and of Parliament, which has swayed his opinion. So there's been no conversation of settlement up until today, when the Western Cape High Court judges called us into court, and that is where this resolution is coming from. But the affidavit by the Minister of Finance, which he supplied as a supplementary affidavit this afternoon to the Western Cape High Court, is quite telling in two ways, Naledi. It states that the Minister of Finance intended to implement the 0.5% VAT increases on the 1st of May, despite the proposals he received from political parties. And we were misled this week by some political parties that there's a reversal of the VAT hike as a result of engagements with the minister. The minister has rubbished those claims. The Minister of Finance has said that those proposals were not sufficient and he intended to proceed with the VAT increases. So the critical importance of this court judgment can never be overlooked. It is the only legitimate process which has stopped the VAT hikes on the 1st of May. And I think South Africans should become to appreciate that, but begin to appreciate that the consequences of this are that we and the Democratic Alliance had in the Standing Committee on Finance proposed amendments to the fiscal framework where the Minister of Finance was able to would have been able to consider them over a period of 2 days, as according to the Money Bills Amendment Act. Mm. Now, these political parties voted against those amendments and those proposals by us in the Standing Committee on Finance and proceeded to do some unprocedural and illegal adoption of the fiscal framework there. And they said they were doing this because they intended to save South Africa from not having a budget. The consequences of the actions of the African National Congress, of BOSA, of Action SA, of Rise Mzansi now, are that South Africa doesn't have a budget because they tried to pass a fiscal framework illegally. Mm. So we are here today in a crisis of a nation without a budget because of the incompetence of the ANC and the illegality that was supported by Herman Mashaba, by Musi Maimane, by Songa Zozibi, by Gaetan McKenzie, by Mzwanele Nyonso of the PAC, and by Hanif Hendricks of Al Jamaa. These political parties must be remembered as having thrown South Africa into a fiscal crisis, and they must be condemned by history for that.
Yeah, of course, the argument of the EFF has, for the longest time, also been around the process. You say the adoption of the fiscal framework being irregular, the process now, and it's important then to look at what happens next, what it is that you'll be watching out for to ensure that the process that we see moving forward is regular and not irregular, if you will. But also, there is the issue around just how much wrangling needs to happen and with what role the EFF then plays in what we do in the meantime. When you do have a finance minister that has argued that there is a 75 billion rand shortfall in that budget.
Look, the Speaker of the National Assembly has just now released a communication which we will share with the public, where she has said the budget process now needs to begin from scratch. So that confirms what we've been saying, what the president of the EFF has said this afternoon, that South Africa is without a budget. So the Minister of Finance is now expected to table the budget of South Africa for the third time. Remember, this is happening for the third time now. On the 19th of February, it was postponed. One was presented later on in March, on the 12th of March, to be exact. And now he has to come back and present another one because of their attempts of illegality and taxing the poor and middle class of South Africa. So we are aware that the Minister of Finance is claiming that the next budget is going to table. We must take fiscal responsibility. And I think something nonsensical was said by the leader of Rise Mzansi in an article on the City Press this afternoon as well, that we must now take responsibility when they are the ones who should be held to account, because they said they want a reversal of the rate hikes through their alternative proposals, which they could.
At my age, you start appreciating things you might have taken for granted before, like good health. I've known from early on that donating blood regularly was indeed good for my health. I'm too old now, but I've done my part in saving hundreds of lives while benefiting my own. You see, my risk of a heart attack, stroke, and cancer was always low because I donated blood.
Call NHB on 061-285-5400. We're about you.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
All right, the time is 30 minutes in the after 6 o'clock, and this is Early Morning Scoop. Just for the last update from the international side of
vaping, what's more?
The vaping, once marketed as a safer alternative to smoking, has exploded in popularity among the South African teen, with nearly one in five high school people now using e-cigarettes. Now, but behind the fun flavors, and of course, sleek designed lies a growing mental health health crisis, which research showing that nicotine addiction in adolescent worsen depression, anxiety, and even suicidal thoughts. We might take a listen to this last update.
So damaging to adolescent brains.
Well, nicotine is a toxin, and we know that the brain is developing right up until the age of 25. So it has particularly toxic effects on specific areas of the brain. So we talk about predominantly the frontal lobe. So it has specific areas functioning, for example, in memory function, impulsivity, and concentration. So that limits functioning at the present, and then this causes impairments in neurodevelopment later on, so that impacting a teen's ability to be a functional young adult and an adult, because it affects memory, organizational functioning, and planning abilities. We know that in the short term, that 7% of teens or tweens, as this starts very on early on from age 12, 7% will develop low mood as a result of vaping, as well as increased irritability and anxiety symptoms in the short term. But this also contributes to lasting effects on mental health throughout adolescence as they continue. And we're talking about, once again, low mood, anxiety, impulsivity, and suicidality in the short and the long term.
Now, we understand that many teens vape to cope with stress, but we also understand that it actually worsens mental health. Can you explain this vicious cycle? And obviously, what did teens do when they were stressed before vaping was an alternative?
So there's a bi-directional relationship. So teens who are anxious or have a low mood may vape because they say it makes them feel calmer or less stressed. But then again, vaping causes the same thing, anxiety and low mood. So I think the focus is on trying to offer teens more effective coping skills and healthier coping skills than something like vaping. So I think beforehand, ideally, it would be to talk to someone, but also to find the underlying reason for the anxiety. What are the factors that are driving that? Is it school factors, learning factors? Are there issues with peers? Is there bullying? Are there family factors at home that are driving that anxiety. So very important to understand where it's coming from, because perhaps we can help with those particular issues. And then it's about good self-care that all teens should be practicing. And then specific help around this anxiety in terms of coping skills, such as journaling, getting exercise, healthy interaction with family, healthy interaction with friends, and ways to sort of minimize the anxiety in the short term and in the long term by providing good support.
Now, Dr. Henderson, I'd imagine that for many parents, they're not familiar that their teens are vaping, and those that are obviously trying to stop it. Now, years ago when kids were taking cigarettes, you know, there were telltale signs, right? So whether it's the darkening of the lips or the odor from the various cigarettes, that would allow parents to identify that their children were smoking. What are the telltale signs for kids that are vaping? What can parents look out for?
So unfortunately, the new vapes, they're called pod mods, are specifically created to cause less of a plume. So for example, you don't see the vapor as much as you would with a cigarette. So it's easier to hide. But from the behavioral point of view, well, sometimes it's really obvious. Kids are vaping when they wake up, when they're getting dressed for school, when they're eating their breakfast. That's quite noticeable. Otherwise, it would be, for example, perhaps the increased irritability, and that particularly shows through when there's addiction taking place. So focusing on how to get a vape, when to get a vape, but a look at irritability and a poor focus on what they need to be doing. So their normal activities, such as schooling and learning procedures and interactions with others. And, of course, a lot of parents do find a lot of vapes. So, for example, parents who search bedrooms often find vapes hidden in socks, hidden under drawers. And so it's something that most parents should be looking at, actually, especially for we know that our young tweens and teens is where it starts. So I think a conversation should be had with all tweens and teens about vaping.
Right. There you had it. Now the time is 36 minutes in the off 6 o'clock, and this is Early Morning Scoop. And we can go into a very short commercial break, then once we return, we'll take you through the economic news update within the country.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud. So
not a fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who knows does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in parliament, let me not take up my Katatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura, and I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before. It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the
views and opinions expressed by our guests and callers are not those of Eagle FM and any of its staff.
Get social with us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Our handle is Eagle FM Namibia.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Back your preconceptions of technology. Explore the apps that are redefining the future. Out with the old and in with the new. From carrying physical hard copy hymn books to the world of digital hymn book versions. See the bold new expressions of the Imba app. Feel like you're part of something bigger. Experience the digital hymn book in the palm of your hands. Behold, the new and improved Imba that brings together various.
All right, it is 36 minutes in the off 6 o'clock, and this is Early Morning Scoop. Now, to start off with one of the lead story in our newspapers today, please don't forget to always subscribe to the WhatsApp channel that is now Eagle FM Media House, and you can always catch up through on the in terms of newspaper alerts and, of course, the daily news update. And, of course, do not forget or pass me just to send through your details. That's to 081-241-44. That's the number you can always send through your details. This way you can be able to get the newspaper every day's release. That's Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Now, to start off, is just the Mati Amokwa, chairperson of the Confederation of Namibia Fishing Associations, says government quota auctions are reaching prices that do not show the real economic value of the quotas. Now, he says the prices ignores the National Development Plan goals of creating jobs and adding value. Now, speaking at the annual fishing industry address on Friday, Amokwa said the government quotas approach is creating instability and uncertainty in the sector. Now, he cautions that the auction system is moving Namibia away from its rights-based fisheries management system toward an unpredictable vessel-based system similar to pre-independence era. Now, such auctions are such quotas without obligation between overvalued and should not be seen as a targeted achievable of the full total allowance catch that is stuck and auctioning fishing quotas to the highest bidder is not provided for in the Marine Resources Act of 2000. Now, does not maximize value for the nation and undermines long-term employment and value addition objectives. That's what Amokwa said. Namibia introduced the fish quota auction system in 2020. The Ministry of Finance and Public Enterprises and the Ministry of Fisheries and Marine Resources auction specific quotas to the highest bidder. Now, the government set minimum prices at 3,000 Namibian dollars per quota for freezer quota and 750 Namibian dollars per quota for wet quota. Those increase in 2024 to 3,500 Namibian dollars for freezer quota and 850 Namibian dollars for wet quota. Now, in 2021, Namibia raised $38 million through six auctions, selling 86,040 metric tonne. In February this year, the government invited bids for 23,780 metric tons of horse mackerel and 5,000 metric tons of hake. Now, last year's sale offered 13,584 metric tons of horse mackerel and 1,000 metric tons of mock fish. Now, cabinet has approved a tag of 270,000 metric tons for horse mackerel in 2024, down from 290,000 in 2023 and 330,000 30,000 in 2022. Now, on Friday, cabinet set the tag for mock and 9,600 metric tons for the 2025 to 2026 fishing season running from 15 May 2025 to 30 April 2026. Now, the ICT Minister Emma Teofelos announced the decision following the fourth cabinet meeting held on Wednesday. Now, Amokwa said the auction model discourages Namibia efforts. Now, operators without employment or value addition obligation are better positioned to participate, disadvantaging established companies employing thousands of Namibians and new right holders trying to enter the industry. Now, the auction system creates uncertainty because no one can predict how much fish they will win in the next season. Therefore, no one can also invest long-term in such conditions. Innovation in value addition is also suffered because the government is limited in imposing further condition once an auction is won. That's what Amokwa said. Now, he expressed concern over the growing insurance of quota to the government itself, which he said is now the largest quota holder. Now, he said this sustains vessel operators who no longer comply with employment requirement on or rather long-term obligation eroded the gains made since independence. Now, in July last year, the Namibian Competition Commission initiated a second investigation into fishing companies that owned vessels for illegally allegedly imposing unfair purchase prices when negotiating quotas usage fees with rights holders without vessels in the horse mackerel subsector. Now, the commission said companies allegedly imposed lower usage fees well below the government's minimum reserve price. Now, according to the commission, Namibia has 11 companies harvesting horse mackerel and 128 horse mackerel rights holders and 20 joint ventures without vessels and 20 operated vessels in the horse mackerel subsector. Now, Mokwa also raised concern about illegal fishing along the northern coast. The illegal catches are complete directly without legally caught a fish in the same market, existing downward pressure on prices. That's what he said. Illegal landings not recorded comprising task and calculated and long-term sustainability. Now, he called for unity in the sector when playing as a team. Every player has responsibility and we all play together. That's what he said. Amoba also won against a preferable treatment of certain rights holders. All right holders are equal before the law and should be treated as such. Now, we must also do away with the perception that some right holders are more equal than others. That what he said. He also urged the government to speed up the licensing process for fishing vessels, saying delays harm companies' operational plannings. Now, he also called for a predictable quota allocation system that rewards employment creation, investment, and consistent performance. Now, the industry needs stability to plan for the future, retain job, and contribute to the country's economic development, he said. Now, on that regard, that what he said. Now, to move on to the next item, is that meanwhile, the Deputy Minister of Agriculture, Fishery and Marine Resources, Ruth Maseke, called for the national science-based strategy to address concern over diminishing fish stocks. We are fully aware of the growing concern about diminishing fish stocks. Now, this issue threatens not only the sustainability of the industry, but also the livelihood that depends on it. That's what she said. Now, she also said the government will adopt enhanced stock assessments, expand marine protected areas, introduce seasonal crushes where necessary, and strengthen enforcement against illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing through regional cooperation. Now, Maseka said fish remains a key export and a pillar for food and nutrition security, yet many Namibians cannot afford to eat fish regularly. We aim to change this by scaling up inland fisheries and aquaculture, ensuring local distribution through targeted subsidies and regional allocation, and encouraging innovation in processing and packaging to extend shelf life and reduce waste. That's what she said. Now, she also raised concern about the pressure Namibia's marine environment faces from mining, energy exploration, and maritime transport. And of course, she said a blue economy governance framework will guide integrated partial planning, environmental safeguards, and cross sector collaboration to reduce conflicts. Now, the Masaka said the fishery sector must help tackle Namibia's higher youth unemployment rate by promoting onshore processing, value addition, training, technology transfer, and of course SME support and empowerment women and youth-owned cooperatives and at an national fishes. Now, as emphasized by the president, we cannot talk about development while youth unemployment stands at about over 44%, she said. Now, the fishery sector must rise the auctions occasion as a driver of decent work and industrialization. That's what she said. She also invites stakeholders to partner with the ministry to co-develop an industry-led action plan, set up joint investment platform for research, training, and establishing real-time feedback and on that. On our next item, yeah, on our next item on Thursday, President Tumulo Ndaitwa announced that the government will fully cover tuition and, of course, registration fees at all public universities and, of course, vocational centers starting from the 2026 academic year. Now, joining us in studio right now is NASO's president, that is Madam Ndolthia Nangolo. A very good morning to you, Ms. Ndolthia, and welcome to the Early Morning Scoop.
Good morning, and thank you very much for having me.
We are doing great. Yeah, you have been really advocating for this, and especially given the challenges that learners face with registration fees, of course. Maybe what are your thoughts on this decision as the president of NANSO, and of course, how will this maybe decision benefit Namibian children?
Thank you very much. I think from the get-go, I'm very overwhelmed with excitement and joy, primarily because this is something that was considered over ambitious when we were advocating for it, or when we called for it. Many told us we are over ambitious, but it's a reality. This means that the President of the Republic of Namibia and the government is listening. We are seeing the issues and the challenges that students are facing. They are seeing the gaps in our education, and the president is actively working to resolve those gaps, and we're absolutely grateful and overjoyed. What this means is a student, an ordinary student from Sarusungu, his mother cannot afford 2,000 for registration, whose mother cannot afford that more than 60,000 for tuition. He's able to get on a bus now at the beginning of the year without any worry that they have to pay registration, that's expensive, and they're able to register and start their education. That is a big and we reflect on it because we know what our students go through at the beginning of every year. For some who are privileged, 2,000, 3,000, 5,000 is small money to them for registration. But for our many students who are disadvantaged, that's a large sum of money. And now, for the first time, our students are able to access education.
NASOs represent both public and, of course, private educational institutions. Now, the president herself only mentioned about the public universities, of course, in her announcement. Now, as the president of NASO, what do you maybe think will happen for students in private institutions who will continue also to face tuition fees?
I think there is a misconception going on around NSFAF is coming to an end, or NSFAF is being done away with. That is not the case. I don't believe that is the case. NSFAF as an institution is now a direct threat under the ministry. That means there is an intention for continuity. So NSFAF will remain there. And NSFAF must remain and must continue to support those at private institutions, because otherwise it would be unfair to then pull away the funding for those private institutions. And then it's just two public institutions that are able to cater to all students in the country. So I don't believe in the notion that NSFAF will be done away with. I think the president has a plan and a strategy. And I think I can tell the students to rest assured that at the end of the day, whatever it is, NANSO will fight for the best interest of our students, both the public and those at private institutions, regardless.
Yeah, and of course, maybe what additional measures need to be done, whether to be implemented to improve the education sector further, as what do you maybe suggest that maybe need to be done in order at least the education sector will be the better sector ever?
I think we need to, now that there's free higher education,
we must be able to deal with the issue of quality. MCHE must be able to carry out, must receive the support it needs to carry out its statutory mandate, which is to ensure that there's quality higher education in Namibia. But even so, we must be able to strictly align the courses and to ensure that our graduates are able to be absorbed by the job market and the courses align with the job market. Because what we are foreseeing here is education is free. Everybody will now start studying every single thing on the face of the earth. And there are no jobs. So there must be some sort of regulation. Because back then, the issue of the regulation was mainly based on funding. So UNAM could regulate because, okay, we need 500 students, but there's a possibility that only 400 or 300 will be able to afford. So we are still within the cap. But now it's free. So you'll have 2,000 students applying for a course because the issue of funding is no longer an issue. So there must still be these caps that are in place to allow us to produce graduates that are able to go into employment. But this comes also with government announcing that they are offering internships to students and graduates. So it comes at a perfect time. I think it's to say congratulations to my students, those that are graduating or those that have graduated, but also to say congratulations to every student who continues to support NANSO and who continues to push and hold NANSO accountable. Last year when I was elected in 2024, on the 4th of July, as president, I committed myself to fight for free higher education in this country. And students continue to hold me and my leadership accountable. We are seeing a realization of that. So let us celebrate with our victory as students. We've been demanding for this. We've called for it. We've cried for it. Let us celebrate, and to the parents equally so, let us celebrate and congratulate our President of the Republic of Namibia for her remarkable leadership and for showing us that indeed it's not business as usual and the country is in very capable hands.
Thank you so much, Ms. Anankolo, for that.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right, another student leader, Bernard Akaveu, shared his thought on this particular subject.
Well, first of all, we must start from the grassroots. Number one, President comments, it's distorted. She claims that this decision that has been taken is in the best interest of Namibian, which I strongly do not agree. It's because last month or the previous month, all student bodies in Namibia rejected the notion of NSO to be reintegrated within the Ministry of Education. The reason for rejection is because of many things which are not clear. And one of it was to say, why is there a discrimination of students based on the institution which they are studying? Another one, it's not clear whether tuition will be there or non-tuition will also be there. Then we requested the line ministry to say, let's not go ahead with this policy, put it on hold while we do engagement. But surprisingly, through SONA, President Netumbo goes ahead and say, NSF will be reintegrated. This is a disappointment. It shows that the president claims that she's a representative of the youth, but directly it's only a decision that's being taken and those of her advisors, or to say it's only those that are politically affiliated to her. So on our basis, we reject this notion. We call upon her to give us space to the young people of this country to discuss on our own discourse, because all this matter affect us. There's no decision that can be taken without young people themselves being involved.
I mean, on, as the student leader also, what do you say at the side of the private institution? What do you say? What will happen to the student? Because, of course, obviously, they will continue to pay their school fees.
This is a political matter. That is the first point. But my point of clarity to the nation is people must understand, including President Netumbo Nandi, that she was voted by youth who study from institution, be it public or private institution. She is the president of Namibian youth, and regardless of wherever they study, she must remember that she's representing all of them, and they voted for her. So her only waking up to say tuition fee and registration fee will be covered by government only at public institution. That one, it does not augur well with me. And we believe it does not augur well with our members as well.
Mm.
That contradicts the Namibian Constitution under Article 20 that speaks about the right to education. So as a former diplomat like Madam Netumbo, we believe she's fully aware, and to, it would be worrisome for a president of the country speaking on SONA and to speaking about policies that speaks about discrimination of our own constitution. Secondly, what is worrisome is that even those that would be funded at a public institution, she clearly stated that parents has to come in. How do they come in? They will have to pay other living expenses such as accommodation, transportation, and many others.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you an example. How much is accommodation in the Mona, which is in Windu? It's on average, it's 24,000 and more. Now I'm thinking of a child who's coming from Kachina Kachi. This child has been taken care of by the government, subsidies from grade 0 until grade 12, because this child is certified as parents are unemployed and is coming from marginalized. So immediately, where will this child get money in order for them to pay for their own transportation, to pay for their own accommodation? Literally, this shows that what the president is saying did not go through a proper consultation. This policy will marginalize the needy students. This policy will marginalize parents that are suffering today because they fought for this country. They are unable to get employment. That is a point. There's nothing to celebrate even for public institutions. To make it worse for private institution students, people must understand that government does not fund private institutions, but government funds students. So the funding model should always be funding a Namibian student regardless of where they are. So if she's saying that accommodation will be covered by the parents, now we wonder, is she going to dissolve NSFAF? What will be the role of NSFAF then? So there's still a need of clarion call for us to sit around the table and discuss this matter collectively so that we can get the best amicable solution for our country.
Give us your thought, or what are MEPG's additional measures need to be also implemented just to improve also this sector, which is now the education, maybe going forward also?
When it comes to funding, our first priority is that when you are funding students, it must never be politicized. We must remember history that NSFAF was already under a Ministry of Education. Let's question ourselves, why was it moved to become independently? We personally support an independent body without political interference. Because where there's politics, there's always a way of choosing who to support and who's not there to support. Like in this case, we strongly feel that there are two elephants fighting. And these two elephants may be the owners of private institutions against the government of the day, or to be specifically maybe Netumbo. So once you give a political head to head the affairs of interests of the Namibian people, the young people will suffer. We want an independent financial scheme that will look at a Namibian student as a Namibian student, not a student who support IPC, not a student who support AR, not a student who support SWAPO. We want to see all Namibian students as students of this country, not based on political affiliation. And we want someone with sober mind that will look at a student and look, here is a marginalized Namibian student who must benefit equally as per their right to the economy of this country, who must benefit equally to our fishes, who must benefit equally to the diamonds, who must benefit equally to the tourism industry. These resources belongs to all of us Namibians, regardless of the political affiliation where we are, regardless of which institution we are studying with. Namibia belongs to all of us. In the manifesto of SWAPO, it speaks about unity of diversity. In the SONA, the president spoke about unity of diversity. The president spoke about youth inclusion. But if the youth are being have been, in this case now, the youths have been separated based on the institution of their choice. So the paper which the president have read, it remains just a paper of her own thoughts without any consultation. She needs to be advised. We need to go back to the drawing board. Everyone must be consulted. All Namibians have the right to be treated equal regardless of where they are studying. Fighting for student equality, we can never compromise about it, and we'll stand firm with our decisions. No, the students must remain calm. They must not worry. The true representatives of the students are going to fight this injustice. We will engage the president. If the president does not understand table discussion, we'll go back our old tricks of real demonstrations. We are going to visit all the state house under demonstration if she does not want to change this. And we can promise you we'll do that. The youth are united and will not allow this.
All right. Thank you so much for having you on the early morning skip today.
Thank you very much. Good day ahead.
All right.
All right, there you heard it from Bernard Kaveu, one of the student leader in the country. Now the time is 4 minutes in the hour, 7 o'clock, and it's early morning scoop. Now to move on to the next item is that my colleague Sharon Seaman engaged in conversation with Julia Naukushu, a business analyst, and of course to discuss the unsuccessfully proposal regarding the 0.5% of VAT in the South Africa. We might take a listen to this particular update.
They are saying South African Minister Finance Minister Enoch Godongwana stated that the government has reversed the proposed 0.5% point VAT point VAT increase that was due to take effect on 1st of May 2025. The South African administration has tried to increase its revenue collection by increasing the VAT with 2% from 15% to 17% upon GNU tension, and the ANC government proposed a 0.5 increase, which has ended up being scrapped. So what is the alternative financial revenue collection the SA will be using to fill its financial gap?
Alright, thank you for the question. Okay, I'm hearing about the South African government, what's happening about the VAT. So I would like to say that the South African government, after revising the proposal for 0% VAT increase, is likely to pursue a mix of alternative strategies to fill it with financial gap. Although the specific alternatives were not detailed in your prompt, based on a typical government strategies and trial announcement by Finance Minister, you say this Enoch Godongwana, possible alternatives include, it might include the improved tax compliance and enforcement, whereby strengthening the South African Revenue Services to close tax loopholes and press down on tax evasion.
Okay.
And the other point I can say is wealth and corporate taxation, whereby adjusting the to personal income tax for high earners or introducing new levies on luxury goods or specific sectors such as mining and financial services. And we can also look at the public-private partnership, whereby engaging private sector's investment into infrastructure projects to reduce the direct fiscal burden. And we can also look at the borrowing, whereby issuing bonds or seeking loans to cover short-term deficits. Though this could increase the debt level, and we can also look at the expenditure cuts the liberalization, whereby relocating funds from non-essential spending and cutting wasteful expenditure. Yeah, that's all I can say about this.
So what can Namibia learn from South Africa regarding revenue collections?
Okay, Namibia can learn several lessons from South Africa experience, whereby stakeholders engaging is a key. For example, that the backlash from the public and internal government coalition like the GNU tensions shows the importance of inclusive, I mean, decision-making before implementing tax increases. And we can also look at the diversification of revenue resources or sale sources, whereby relying heavily on consumption taxes like VAT can be risky sometimes. Namibia can also explore broader tax bases or based on digital services, environmental levies or levels, and also informal taxation. We can also look at the balance between taxation and economic impact, like that increasing VAT can hurt low-income householders and dampen consumers spending in Namibia. Like in Namibia, should also consider the economic and social impact at taxi policy changes. They can also look at transparent fiscal management, whereby building public trust is through transparency in how taxes are used to increase willingness to improve. Not to improve, but to comply, I mean, sorry. And the other thing is to strengthen compliance over tax hikes, whereby improving collection efficiency can be more effective and politically accepted than increasing tax rates. Yeah. That's what I can see, how Namibia can learn from South Africa regarding the revenue collection.
Okay. So the revenue collection pressure was forced by inadequate collections of revenues in South Africa treasury. Does halting of revenue strategy mean it will find money somewhere, or does this have an impact on Namibia, South Africa's trade?
Okay, this is a bit a funny question, but on my own opinion, let me say yes. South Africa can find money elsewhere, whereby helping on the VAT hike likely means the government will look on for funding from other sources through borrowing, and the expenditure cuts and improving compliance. So, however, I can say these are not the Galandis quick fixes, so it can create pressure on debt sustainability. And we can check on impact on Namibia or to SA trade, whereby we can say, yes, there could be an impact. South Africa is Namibia's largest trading partner. If we know most of our things from South Africa, and the economic instability and fiscal pressure in South Africa could affect the exchange rate, impacting the Namibian dollar. Equal to the South African rand. As you know, like sometimes when we are going to SA, we are being told like, no, we must have Zara, those rand money. You cannot go with Namibian money to South Africa, you understand?
Okay.
And the other thing, we can reduce the consumer demand. Like in South Africa, potential affecting Namibia export. As I told you, most of our things are from SA. And we can also check on the influence of secure living use for the other countries, you understand? Whereby since Namibia received a share of customs living use through the Southern African Custom Union, if South Africa collects less, Namibia might receive less also in secure transfers. And we can also look at the great investor uncertainty in the region directly affecting the media's economy outlook. And, I can say this, like, Namibia is more dependable on SA. And the other thing, we are more into doing our things depending on SA. So that's all I can say.
Okay. Okay, thank you so much, Julia, for being with us and speaking to us on the
Bye.
All right, it's 12 minutes in the of 7 o'clock, and this is Elimoni Skibuko until the of 7:30. So, of course, the next program is the unpacking of the day. Please do not forget to always also stay tuned for the next of the programming. Now, to move on to the next item is that the Minister of Education, Innovation, Youth, Sports, Art and Culture, started a state camp, emphasizes now teachers to take more action in their practices to help children understand better. Now, she made those remarks during the UNAM Windu graduation ceremony on Friday. We might take a listen to this particular update.
And it is therefore your task as teachers to translate national policies into the practical action in each school and to ensure that you embrace a culture that is inclusive and respectful of every child. This quote really take together and summarize everything that has been said by the former speakers. Even if it is three things that you take away today, please do take away something. As you might be aware, in addition to the National Professional Standards for Teachers in Namibia, the Ministry has also been working on the drafting of the Namibia Teaching Professional Act. The object of the bill, amongst others, is to provide for the establishment, the constitution, the powers and the functions of a regulatory body or a council that will regulate the teaching profession in Namibia. We have to get it right. And the draft bill further prohibits people from entering the teaching profession without being registered as professional educators. Very briefly, this bill intends to professionalize and promote and enhance the image and the status of this very noble and sacred teaching profession. And by implication, I believe wholeheartedly we will improve the quality of our education. Because access is not everything if we can't pay it with quality. So, in essence, we wish to advocate that teaching should be regarded not just as a profession, but as the profession, a form of public service which requires of teachers expert knowledge. Expert knowledge. You don't stop learning when you walk away with today from your graduation. You continue learning. So we require expert knowledge, specialized skills, and truly to acquire and maintain that through rigorous and continuing study. It also calls for a sense of personal and corporate responsibility for the education and welfare of the pupils in their charge. Dear graduates, a lot has been said already. I wish to emphasize pertinent issues, and I wish you to be conscious at all times that you have chosen the teaching profession out of your own will and with a purpose. And this purpose is to serve others by facilitating each learner's growth and holistic development. Every child that makes it to grade 12, to AS level, every child that has the ability then through the analytical thinking skills that has been groomed by you, you know, the critical abilities to solve problems and make decisions and informed decisions will have a chance to either through further studies or through work change the life of at least 7 to 14. People in their care. And that is what you are called for to do, to transform the lives of others. The abilities that you must instill in our learners to have fulfilling and productive lives. Therefore, I wish to state that entering the competitive world of work, you would need to be competent. You would need to be confident. It starts with the way you walk. Confidence starts in the way we carry ourselves, It's not about being the best dressed teacher. It starts with how do I carry myself.
All right, on that, she further stated challenges and how UNAM should play a role.
In terms of the youth, where and how can we complement each other? We have to find the synergies. We are now one Ministry of Education and Innovation, added with the other four portfolios. What role is the University of Namibia going to play in this innovation as well? We've heard that Namibia faced multifaceted challenges that really demand our innovative and practical solutions. Among these are issues of water security, high unemployment rates, energy insecurity, and the over-reliance on raw mineral exports. We have an underdeveloped manufacturing sector. We have issues of inadequate housing and insufficient transport infrastructure to support our economic and social development. But each of these challenges, ladies and gentlemen, is not only an obstacle to progress development. These are also opportunities for our researchers, for our engineers to innovate, to collaborate, and to lead. The moment is now, not later. UNAM have shown that it is a leader in providing the solutions, especially those related to water. Since UNAM has its own desalination plant. Did you know that? Give them a round of applause. A round of applause. So UNAM is truly also at a stage where they are going to introduce cutting-edge programs that are designed to address national and regional needs. I'll just mention two. A manufacturing and engineering program that specializes in welding engineering, the first of its kind in Namibia. This program is poised to support industrialization and advanced manufacturing. There are also discussions and planning towards a Department of Nuclear Science applications in specializations in energy, agriculture, and medicine. We've heard Her Excellency spoke yesterday about one of the seven key priorities was agriculture. And UNAM surely has already been preparing. So UNAM is a leader in that. We need all of you to support this. These initiatives are part of UNAM's broader mission to really create a robust research and development ecosystem in engineering and technological development for impact. And as the Minister of Education, I firmly believe that research is not just an academic exercise for the pursuit of science, but also a driver to solutions that directly impact the lives of Namibians. And we need more funding for research. That is a given. We need more funding for research. Because this research that we will conduct will be aimed at addressing the pressing needs of our society while positioning us as a leader in innovation and sustainability.
All right, it's 21 minutes in the hour, 7 o'clock. Now, to move on to the next item is that the mining industry spent over 24 billion Namibian dollars on goods and services from Namibian businesses in 2024. Now, this represents 46.2% of the sector's total revenue of about 52 billion Namibian dollars. Now, the figures were revealed by the president of the Chamber of the Mines of Namibia, Zebra Kasete, in his mining industry revenue for 2024. Now, despite a challenging year, the mining industry continues to be a strong pillar of our economy, fostering inclusive growth through higher local procurement and employment creation. That's what Kasete said. Now, he also highlighted that procurement efforts are key to long-term and socio-economic development, empowering local businesses and communities cities across the country. Now, employment in the mining sector grew by 11.6% in 2024, with about 20,654 people directly employed compared to 18,189 the previous year. The previous year, now Cassetti noted that this expansion highlights the sector's resilience, even as some retrenchment were recorded. According to him, the industry wage bill reached about 7,000 billion Namibian dollar. Mining employees contribute about 1 billion Namibian dollars in pay as you earn task and strengthening household income and public revenue. Now, despite favorable global price for uranium, gold, copper, and zinc, Namibians mining and acquiring sector contracted by 1.2% in real value added, revising the 12.4% growth recorded in 2023. Now, Cassetti explained that the decline was mainly due to the 3.7% drop in diamond mining output, caused by weaker global prices, reduced demand, and strategic production cuts to maintain market stability. Now, meanwhile, uranium mining grew by 1.8%, slowly, sharply from the 29.6% surge in 2023. And he said water supply issues and plant maintenance at key mines affected operations. Now, Cassetti stated that the increased production from the Renga and Ridge mines helped cushion the slowdown, and global production grew by 2.7% due to recorded output at the Navacheb gold mine. Now, the chamber mentioned that revenue in the mining sector rose by 1.4% to about 52 billion Namibian dollars. Profitable improved by 3.3% to about 2 billion Namibian dollars. Now, Cassetti said operational efficiency and strong performance in gold and uranium helped offset the challenges faced by the diamond sector. Now, gross fixed capital formation declined by 11.7% to Namibian dollars, to about 5 billion Namibian dollars, reflecting the completion of major infrastructure project and delays new investments. Now, exploration spending rose by 66.6% to 1 billion dollars, showing growing interest in uranium, critical minerals, copper, and gold. Now, on that, the sector's contribution to government revenue declined in 2024, he added. Now, corporate taxes fell by 22.8%, and royalties by 11.3%, and export levies by 0.28%, largely to a weaker diamond sales. Now, Cassetti cautioned that the sector's heavy reliance on diamonds for physical revenue exposed vulnerability. Now, while other minerals perform strongly, the dominance of diamond in the revenue structure meant that challenges in that segment had a pronounced impact on the overall physical contribution. That's what he said. The mining contributed 13.3% to Namibian GDP in the 2024, and Cassetti reaffirmed that mining remained the cornerstone of the country's economy. That's what we are getting. Now, to move on to the one last of the update of the day is that the Urban and Rural Development Minister, James Sankwasa, has called on the government institution and businesses to settle their debts with local authorities. Now, he made the call during the late independence celebration held on Saturday in the Mukwe constituency. Now, Sankwasa said the collective duty of all sectors is to develop the country, not to destroy it. Now, he stressed that if there is true commitment to growth, everyone must pay what they owe. Now, this is not a private money, but the public funds intended for public development, infrastructure, and services that benefit all of us. That's what he said. Now, Sokwase said he had issued a directive last week requesting all local authorities to submit reports on outstanding bills to his office. Now, those reports should indicate how much is owed by each ministry, business, and individual, particularly for essential services like water and electricity, that's what he added. Now, he also noted that only two reports have been received so far. One report showed that a small town like Enana is owed 7 million Namibian dollars by various ministries, businesses, and government institutions. Now, how can we expect to develop our small towns like an improved infrastructure if such a large amount remains unpaid? That what he questioned. Now, last month, the Namibian Water Corporation, that is NamWater, revealed it is owed 2.4 billion Namibian dollars by local authorities, municipalities, town councils, individuals, village councillors, and rural water communities. Now, in 2022, the city of Windhoek disclosed that residents, government ministries, and businesses collectively owed the council about 1.2 billion Namibian dollars. Now, in the same year, the former minister of finance, Minister Ipombo Shimi, stated that the government would not write off a post-independence debt owed by the local authorities, as it would be unfair to other institutions that had honored their repayment agreement. At that time, the total debt, including about 100,000, is incurred in interest from 1990 to 2010 due to non-payment was starting. Now, Sankwasa said the resources needed for development are already available but are being withheld due to the unpaid debts. Now, he demanded that ministries and government institutions start settling their debts without delay. Now, it is easy to complain about potholes and poor public services it's easy also to complain about the borehole in public services, as we often hear in newspapers and, of course, in parliament. That's what he said. However, we cannot expect to improve our communities if we do not hold ourselves accountable. Paying what is owed is not optional. It is also fundamental responsibility. That's what Sakwasa said. Now, he also announced that a deadline has been set for all ministries and institutions to clear their outstanding bills. Now, he said that before November, the next phase will retarget members of parliament, any MP who owed money to a local authority, who will also be required to settle their debt. That's what he said. Now, we must read by example if we expect other to follow, Sankwasa emphasized. Now, he also included saying that we must develop, not to destroy. It's time for action. Let's pay the money owed by the public and stronger, more prosperous future for all. That what Sankwasa added. And now from me, Loisa, that was the last update of the day. Thank you so much for tuning in and to also get something. Thank you so much. And I wish you also the best on listening to all the program of the day. Thank you so much. And I will be handing over to my colleague, that my coach will take you through the usual show, that is Unpicking of the Day. From me, Loisa Shimi, have a good one.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of failure.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in parliament, let me not take up my Katatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you
you off if it is needed to.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before. Mm. It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past. Mm. And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests and callers are not those of Eagle FM and any of its staff.
Get social with us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Our handle is Eagle FM Namibia.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Back your preconceptions of technology. Explore the apps that are redefining the future. Out with the old and in with the new. From carrying physical hard copy hymn books to the world of digital hymn book versions. See the bold new expressions of the Imba app. Feel like you're part of something bigger. Experience the digital hymn book in the palm of your hands. Behold, the new and improved Imba that brings together various hymn books under one app. Here to unite a nation and spread the gospel. Some of the featured hymn books on Imba app are The Elsi Nehangano, The Osherero Omaimburiro, The Catholics Imane Kakarunga, The Africans Sengfuar Diara, and many more. Contact us today if you'd like for your church hymn book to be added onto the list of Imba hymn books. 081-23-58-063. You can also email us at digital@omalaiti.com. Download and discover Imba today. You can find it on the App Store as well as the Google Play Store.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.